This is Audible.
Strengths-Based Leadership, Great Leaders, Teams, and Why People Follow. Written by Tom Rath and Barry Conchi. Read by Tom Rath and Barry Conchi. Dedicated to the pioneering researcher Don Clifton, who spent 4 decades studying the strengths of great leaders. Gallup Press, copyright 2008, Gallup Incorporated. All rights reserved, including the right of reproduction in whole or in part in any form. Gallup, Clifton StrengthsFinder, the Gallup Poll, Gallup Press, Q12, StrengthsFinder, and the 34 Clifton StrengthsFinder theme names are trademarks of Gallup Incorporated. All other trademarks are property of their respective owners. The Q12 items are protected by copyright of Gallup Incorporated, 1993 to 1998. All rights reserved. Gallup Press exists to educate and inform the people who govern, manage, teach, and lead the world's 6 billion citizens. Each book meets Gallup's requirements of integrity, trust, and independence, and is based on Gallup-approved science and research.
I'm Tom Rath, Gallup Global Practice Leader and co-author of Strengths-Based Leadership. First, I would like to take the opportunity to say thank you to the team who made this book happen. Gallup has been studying human behavior for more than 70 years and consulting with organizational leaders for more than 4 decades. Over the years, hundreds of top scientists and leadership consultants have contributed to the collective knowledge base. Even as we write this book, Gallup consultants around the globe are spending their days working with leaders to improve their organization's effectiveness. It is the work of a team of experts, many of whom have devoted their lives to studying great leaders, that fills the pages of this book. We would also like to thank all the people who reviewed drafts of this book, the team who created the website, our research group, and in particular, the many critical friends in our client partnerships who kept us true to our mission and science, and provided many of the subjects of our studies. Without these great partners, this book would not have been possible. And to all of the leaders who gave us their time, we extend our most sincere thanks and gratitude. Introduction. The best leaders get to live on. Think for a moment about the leaders you respect, whether they lead countries, organizations, communities, or families, who continue to live on because of the way they have shaped your thoughts and beliefs. Even though you may not notice it in the moment, the most effective leaders forever alter the course of your life. Chances are you will have many opportunities to lead during your own lifetime. If you're able to seize these opportunities, your influence will continue to grow for generations to come. Maybe it's the desire to make a lasting impact on the world that drives so many of us to want to lead. In a recent Gallup poll, we asked people to rate their own leadership ability. Out of over 1,000 people randomly surveyed, 97% rated their ability to lead as being at or above average. And more than 2/3 said they had led a group or a team. The fact is, whether you are taking charge in a boardroom, on a construction site, or even in your home, it is likely that you will find yourself leading at some point in your life. So what are the keys to being a more effective leader? To answer this question, we assembled a team of experts to review decades of Gallup data on this topic, which included more than 20,000 in-depth interviews with senior leaders, studies of more than 1 million work teams, and 50 years of Gallup polls about the world's most admired leaders. Our team then initiated a study of more than 10,000 followers around the world. In this study, we asked followers to tell us, in their own words, why they followed the most influential leader in their life. 3 key findings emerged from this research. First, the most effective leaders are always investing in strengths. In the workplace, when an organization's leadership fails to focus on individual strengths, the odds of an employee being engaged are a dismal 1 in 11, or 9%. But when an organization's leadership focuses on the strengths of its employees, the odds soar to almost 3 in 4, or 73%. So that means when leaders focus on and invest in their employees' strengths, the odds of each person being engaged goes up eightfold. As we will review in Part 1, this increase in engagement translates into substantial gains for the organization's bottom line and each employee's well-being. Second, the most effective leaders surround themselves with the right people and then maximize their team. While the best leaders are not well-rounded, the best teams are. Our research found that top-performing teams have strengths in four specific domains. In Part 2, you will hear from four well-known leaders as they describe how their strengths play out in these domains. You also see how one CEO maximized his existing team and learn about the elements that differentiated the top-performing teams we studied from the rest of the pack. Third, the most effective leaders understand their followers' needs. People follow leaders for very specific reasons. When we asked thousands of followers, they were able to describe exactly what they need from a leader with remarkable clarity. In Part 3, we will review the results from this study and tell you more about followers' four basic needs. To help you learn about your own strengths as a leader, you will have the opportunity to take a new leadership version of Gallup's StrengthsFinder program. Following an online assessment, you will receive a guide that shows you how your top five strengths fit into the four domains of leadership strength from Part 2. The guide will also give you specific suggestions for meeting the basic needs of those who look to you for leadership from Part 3. But as you will learn from some of the most effective leaders we've studied, the path to great leadership starts with a deep understanding of the strengths you bring to the table. Part 1, investing in your strengths. If you spend your life trying to be good at everything, you will never be great at anything. While our society encourages us to be well-rounded, this approach inadvertently breeds mediocrity. Perhaps the greatest misconception of all is that of the well-rounded leader. Organizations are quick to look for leaders who are great communicators, visionary thinkers, and who can also get things done and follow through. All of these attributes are desirable and necessary for an organization to succeed. But of all the leaders we have studied, we have yet to find one who has world-class strength in all of these areas. Sure, many leaders can get by or above average in several domains, but paradoxically, those who strive to be competent in all areas become the least effective leaders overall. Leading by imitation. Sarah has a knot in her stomach as she drives to work on Monday morning. While she rarely looks forward to the start of a work week, today the mere thought of going to the office is making her ill. While driving through traffic, Sarah begins to wonder why this particular Monday is so much worse. She's perplexed because last Friday was one of the best days in the office she could remember. As Sarah pulls into the parking lot, she figures out why the end of last week was so enjoyable. Her boss, Bob, was out of town. That was the good news. The bad news is that he was attending yet another course that would help equip him to be a better leader. As Sarah walks across the parking lot, her stomach tightens even more when she remembers what happened the last time Bob went to one of those leadership retreats. Earlier in the year, Bob had attended a conference that explored Lincoln's leadership style during the Civil War. When he returned, Bob predictably spent the next month trying to teach everyone on his team to be exceptional communicators. Sarah chuckled at the memory, recalling how awkward this was for the computer programmers in her office, who usually prefer typing to talking. Fortunately, like all Bob's phases, this one came to an abrupt halt once he read a book suggesting that the best leaders had humble personalities, and he subsequently quit pressuring Sarah's more introverted colleagues to be the next Lincoln or Kennedy. When Sarah enters the building, she has no choice but to pass Bob's office, and the knot in her stomach tightens. As if on cue, Bob waves her in. Reluctantly, Sarah leans against the frame of the open door. In her mind, Sarah is cynically wondering what flavor will be served up this month. But to be cordial, Sarah asks Bob about the retreat. After telling Sarah how peaceful and serene it was in the small mountain town where the event was held, Bob cuts to the chase. He declares, "My big takeaway from last week was that we all need to be more adaptive to change in order to grow our business." Then Bob leans forward, looking at Sarah earnestly, and continues. We went through this activity where each of us had to map out how quickly we adapt to new market trends. Well, like everyone else, it turns out that we spend nowhere near enough time readying ourselves for big change. If we're going to lead our industry, we need to not only anticipate, but better yet, create change. Bob rambles on for another 10 minutes, but Sarah had gotten the message right away. The leadership buzzword for the next few weeks or months is going to be change. As Sarah walks away from Bob's office, she is already anticipating the moans and groans of her peers when they hear about the latest fad. Then she suddenly realizes something about Bob that almost has her feeling sorry for him. While he has spent much of his career in a leadership role, the vast majority of her boss's efforts have been focused on trying to mimic traits of leaders he has known or read about. The bookshelf in his office is lined with weighty tomes about famous political and business leaders, dead and alive. When Bob speaks to groups, he frequently quotes the company's CEO and other leaders who have appeared in the media. On occasion, usually when talking to groups of managers and leaders in the organization, Bob even puts together a list of greatest hits of all the things he has learned from studying historical leaders and modern-day corporate chiefs. He describes how all leaders must be empathetic, creative, disciplined, strategic, humble, decisive, and of course, great communicators. Sarah can see that Bob has spent most of his career striving to be just like the leaders he admires, yet he fails to realize that the people he looks up to are all very different. There is no single person who embodies even half of the characteristics on Bob's exhaustive list of what makes a well-rounded leader. And perhaps most strikingly, the one leader that Bob knows the least about is himself. Finding your leadership strengths. Former NATO Supreme Allied Commander Wesley Clark said this in the New York Times Magazine. I've never met an effective leader who wasn't aware of his talents and working to sharpen them. Without an awareness of your strengths, it is almost impossible for you to lead effectively. We all lead in very different ways, based on our talents and our limitations. Serious problems occur when we think we need to be exactly like the leaders we admire. Doing so takes us out of our natural element and practically eliminates our chances of success. If you look at great historical leaders, such as Winston Churchill or Mahatma Gandhi, you might notice more differences than similarities, and it is the differences that defined them and led to their success. Churchill's bold and commanding leadership succeeded in mobilizing a war-ravaged nation. It is unlikely he would have had much success if he had tried to emulate Gandhi's calm and quiet approach. Yet Gandhi's leadership, during India's struggle for independence, was much more effective because he did not try to emulate the domineering leaders of the past. Both men knew their strengths and used them wisely. All too often, leaders are blind to the obvious when it comes to something of critical importance to them, their own personality. Many political and business leaders have self-concepts that are miles away from reality. They simply don't know their own strengths and weaknesses. This is the stuff of parody for late-night talk shows, sitcoms, movies, and stand-up comics. And this problem goes far beyond the boss who thinks he's funny, even though people only laugh at his jokes out of obligation. Most people have encountered a leader who is completely unaware of a glaring weakness. We have spoken with several leaders who claim to be great at developing their people, but when we interview the people they lead, we hear a very different story. In some cases, the leaders in question may be better at demoralizing than developing people. At its worst, this lack of self-awareness can lead to masses of disengaged employees, unhappy customers, and undue stress beyond the workplace. Although less noticeable, another serious problem occurs when people try to lead while having no clue about their natural strengths. Unfortunately, few people have discovered the place in life where they have the most potential for growth. Based on an analysis of Gallup's 2007 Global Client Database, the vast majority of people do not have the opportunity to do what they do best every day in their current job. This problem runs rampant in workplaces throughout the world. It was this problem that led the late leadership researcher and father of strengths psychology, Dr. Donald O. Clifton, to begin studying the unique strengths of leaders. Beginning in the 1960s, Clifton, along with his colleagues from Gallup and the academic world, conducted more than 20,000 interviews with people in leadership roles across almost all industries and occupations, including former heads of state and other global leaders. Each of these 90-minute interviews was carefully structured. For most of the interviews, the various leaders were asked the exact same questions. This allowed for side-by-side comparisons of leaders' responses. For many business leaders in this study, data on the leader's actual performance were available. This allowed Clifton and his team to compare the best leaders to those who were less successful, based on objective measures. After all of this research, you might think that a team of scientists would find at least one strength that all the best leaders shared. But when Clifton was asked, just a few months before his death in 2003, what his greatest discovery was from 3 decades of leadership research, this was his response. A leader needs to know his strengths as a carpenter knows his tools, or as a physician knows the instruments at her disposal. What great leaders have in common is that each truly knows his or her strengths and can call on the right strength at the right time. This explains why there is no definitive list of characteristics that describes all leaders. To help aspiring leaders identify their strengths, Clifton and his team created a web-based program dubbed StrengthsFinder. As a part of this audiobook, you will have an opportunity to take a new leadership version of the StrengthsFinder program. In addition to helping you discover your own strengths to lead, this new version will provide you with several strategies for leading other people based on their unique strengths. If you are able to help the people you lead focus on their strengths, it will dramatically boost engagement levels throughout your organization. A long-term investment. As one top executive summarized, if you focus on people's weaknesses, they lose confidence. At a very basic level, it is hard for us to build self-confidence when we are focused on our weaknesses instead of our strengths. Over the past decade, Gallup scientists have explored in much more detail the mechanisms through which a strengths-based approach influences our lives. These studies revealed that people experience significant gains in self-confidence after taking StrengthsFinder and learning more about their strengths. This increase in confidence at an individual level may help explain how strengths-based programs boost an organization's overall engagement and productivity. The awareness of one's strengths and the subsequent increase in self-confidence it produces might have longer-term implications as well, according to a landmark 2008 study led by the University of Florida's Tim Judge. Judge and his colleague Charlize Hurst studied the self-evaluations of 7,660 men and women who were between the ages of 14 and 22 when they were first studied in 1979. These participants were followed for the next 25 years, and the measures about career success, job status, education, and health were repeated in 2004. What Judge and Hurst discovered from this 25-year longitudinal study was quite profound. They found that people with higher self-confidence in 1979 ended up with higher income levels and career satisfaction in 2004. But what was even more striking was the fact that people with high self-confidence in 1979 saw their income increase at an entirely different rate compared to those with lower levels of self-confidence. The people who had more confidence in their abilities at a young age, between the ages of 14 and 22, started off with slightly higher income levels, making on average in 1979 $3,496 more per year than the low confidence group. As each year went by, this gap continued to widen. When the researchers reviewed follow-up studies from 2004, the group with higher self-confidence was making $12,821 more annually compared to the average annual income for the lower self-confidence group. The people with higher self-confidence in 1979 continued to capitalize on their disproportionate gains as each year passed. in addition to the income and career benefits. What Judgenhurst discovered about the link between early self-confidence and physical health may be even more surprising. When asked about the number of health problems they have that interfere with their work, the group with low self-confidence in 1979 reported almost three times as many health problems 25 years later in 2004. Almost unbelievably, the group with high self-evaluations in 1979 reported having fewer health problems in 2004 than they did 25 years before. The results of this study suggest that people who are aware of their strengths and build self-confidence at a young age may reap a cumulative advantage that continues to grow over a lifetime. A preliminary Gallup analysis, using the same longitudinal panel from Judge and Hurst's study, suggests that people who report having a chance to use their strengths in the workplace gain a similar advantage. Our research team found that people who had the opportunity to use their strengths early on in life, between the ages of 15 and 23, had significantly higher job satisfaction and income levels 26 years later. These outcomes highlight the value of leaders knowing their own strengths and also reveal how important it is for leaders to help others uncover their strengths as early as possible. If an organization's leaders are able to help each person capitalize on this cumulative advantage, it is likely to create more rapid individual and organizational growth. These studies also reveal a mechanism through which a truly strengths-based organization may be able to grow at an entirely different rate for decades to come. Part 2. Maximizing your team. Effective leaders surround themselves with the right people and build on each person's strengths. Yet in most cases, leadership teams are a product of circumstance more than design. Among the executive teams we have studied, team members were selected or promoted based primarily on knowledge or competence. So the best salesperson becomes the chief sales manager, even if he is not a great people manager. The smartest person in IT winds up as the CIO. The top financial expert gets promoted to CFO and so on. Rarely are people recruited to an executive team because their strengths are the best complement to those of the existing team members. When is the last time you heard a leader talking about how your team needed to add a person who not only had the technical competence, but who could also help build stronger relationships within the group? Or someone who could help influence others on behalf of the entire team? The vast majority of the time, we recruit by job function and all but ignore individual strengths. What's worse, when leaders do recruit for strength, they all too often pick people who act, think, or behave like themselves, albeit unintentionally in most cases. It's an age-old dilemma. How is a company supposed to grow, adapt, and change if a domineering CEO continues to pick people who agree with him and who have a similar background and personality? Israeli President Shimon Peres expressed his views on this topic in an interview with Gallup. He said, "What you have to think of is the potential of the person, not his appearance. And if you can discover hidden potentials, that can make a great difference to your organization. You have to distinguish between loyalty and brilliance. Most leaders prefer loyalty over brilliance. They're afraid that they're going to be undercut. My view is different." Peres went on to describe the importance of getting talented people on his leadership teams and helping them to discover more about their unique strengths. What makes a great leadership team? Over the years, Gallup has studied thousands of executive teams. In most cases, our leadership consultants conduct an in-depth interview with a team's formal leader, usually the CEO, and also conduct interviews with each member of the leadership team. This enables us to compare the strengths of each person sitting around the table so that we can start thinking about each one's individual development and succession planning, and perhaps most importantly, how the team looks as a whole. As we worked with these leadership teams, we begin to see that while each member had his or her own unique strengths, the most cohesive and successful teams possess broader groupings of strength. So we went back and initiated our most thorough review of this research to date. From this data set, four distinct domains of leadership strength emerged: executing, influencing, relationship building, and strategic thinking. While these categories appear to be general, especially when compared with the specific themes within StrengthsFinder, it struck us that these broader categories of strengths could be useful for thinking about how leaders can contribute to a team. A more detailed language may work best for individual development, but these broad domains offer a more practical lens for looking at the composition of a team. The four domains of leadership strength are executing, influencing, relationship building, and strategic thinking. We found that it serves a team well to have a representation of strengths in each of these four domains. Instead of one dominant leader who tries to do everything, or individuals who all have similar strengths, contributions from all four domains lead to a strong and cohesive team. Although individuals need not be well-rounded, teams should be. This doesn't mean that each person on a team must have strengths exclusively in a single category. In most cases, each team member will possess some strength in multiple domains. A tool like StrengthsFinder can be useful in determining how all team members can maximize their contribution to the group's collective goals. According to our latest research, the 34 StrengthsFinder themes naturally cluster into these four domains of leadership strength based on a statistical factor analysis and a clinical evaluation by Gallup's top scientists. As you think about how you can contribute to a team and who you need to surround yourself with, these four domains may be a good starting point. Leaders with dominant strength in the executing domain know how to make things happen. When you need someone to implement a solution, these are the people who will work tirelessly to get it done. Leaders with the strength to execute have the ability to catch an idea and make it into a reality. For example, one leader may excel at establishing a quality process using themes such as deliberative or discipline, while the next leader will use her achiever theme to work tirelessly toward a goal. Or a leader with strong arranger may determine the optimal configuration of people needed to complete a task. Those who lead by influencing help their team reach a much broader audience. People with strength in this domain are always selling the team's ideas inside and outside the organization. When you need someone to take charge, speak up, and make sure your group is heard, look to someone with the strength to influence. For example, a leader with a lot of command or self-assurance may use few words, but her confidence will continue to project authority and win followers. In contrast, a leader using communication or woo might get people involved by helping individuals feel comfortable and connected to the issue at hand. Those who lead through relationship building are the essential glue that holds a team together. Without these strengths on a team, in many cases, the group is simply a composite of individuals. In contrast, leaders with exceptional relationship building strength have the unique ability to create groups and organizations that are much greater than the sum of their parts. Within this domain, a leader with positivity and harmony may work hard to minimize distractions and to keep the team's collective energy high. On the other hand, a leader with individualization might use a more targeted approach to getting people involved. Or a leader with strong relator or developer may be a great mentor and guide as he pushes others towards bigger and better achievements. Leaders with great strategic thinking strengths are the ones who keep us all focused on what could be. They are constantly absorbing and analyzing information and helping the team make better decisions. People with strength in this domain continually stretch our thinking for the future. Within this domain, a leader using context or strategic might explain how past events influence present circumstances or navigate the best route for future possibilities. Someone with strong ideation or input may see countless opportunities for growth based on all the information she reviews. Or a leader drawing from his analytical theme might help the team drill into the details of cause and effect. Leadership strengths in action. In recent years, we have studied leaders who built great schools, created major nonprofit organizations, led big businesses, and transformed entire nations. But we have yet to find two leaders who have the exact same sequence of strengths. While two leaders may have identical expectations, the way they reach their goals is always dependent on the unique arrangement of their strengths. To help you see how different effective leadership strengths can be, we asked a few of the top organizational leaders we interviewed if they would be willing to share their strengths and their stories. We selected four leaders, one to illustrate each of the four domains of leadership strength. You will notice that these leaders have multiple strengths in the domain they represent. Throughout the next four sections, you will see how these leaders have leveraged their dominant strengths to drive organizational growth. You will hear from the founder and CEO of one of the most legendary nonprofits of the past century, the president of one of the most respected brands ever, the chairman of one of the world's largest banks, and the chief executive of the largest consumer electronics retailer in the world. As you read each of these stories, you will realize just how different four leaders can be, even at the highest levels of an organization. Executing. The executing themes are achiever, arranger, belief, consistency, deliberative, discipline, focus, responsibility, and restorative. Wendy Kopp is the founder and CEO of Teach for America. Her top five strengths are achiever, competition, responsibility, relator, and strategic. During her senior year at Princeton, Wendy Kopp was simply trying to figure out what to do after she graduated. The last thing on Kopp's mind was starting her own business, let alone launching a national movement. Then in late 1998, while seeking a subject for her senior thesis, Kopp found a topic that piqued her interest: educational inequity. Throughout her time at Princeton, Kopp had noticed two distinct and divergent camps of students, even within that elite institution. One group, composed of students who had attended top-flight East Coast prep schools, often referred to their experience at Princeton as a, quote, cakewalk. The other group, made up of students who had grown up in urban public schools, struggled to meet the academic expectations at the Ivy League university. If it was this bad at Princeton, Kopp thought, then this inequity must be much worse in other parts of the country. She decided to gather a group of fellow students to discuss the broader problem of why it was so hard for most children to get the education they deserved. When the group convened, she heard student after student express interest in teaching, but she also heard them describe how there was no mechanism for attracting top students to the profession, especially in urban areas that had the most dire need. It was during this meeting that Kopp's responsibility theme kicked in. She felt a need to take action, and she started thinking about how she could fix this massive problem. Inspired in large part by the Peace Corps, which was launched by President John F. Kennedy in 1961, Kopp was determined to create a national teacher corps. So, like many idealistic young people, Wendy Kopp wrote a letter to then-President George H.W. Bush, suggesting that he create this new corps. She recommended that recent college graduates commit to 2 years of teaching in underprivileged areas. Kopp didn't hear back from the White House about her idea. But it was her next move that truly separated this big idea from the millions of good thoughts that never make it to fruition. The super-achieving, hands-on undergrad decided that she would build this National Teacher Corps herself. In addition to making educational inequity the focus of her senior thesis, Kopp began researching what it would take to create a national corps of teachers. As she was reviewing recommendations that had been made to President Kennedy about what it would take to establish the Peace Corps, she found a paper from one of Kennedy's advisors suggesting that a minimum of 500 people were necessary from day one to convey the sense of urgency and national importance. This paper inspired Kopp's incredibly ambitious goal. She would find 500 new Corps members in the first year to make her dream of a National Teacher Corps a reality. As Kopp began to run the numbers in terms of what it would take to recruit all of these high-achieving students to volunteer for 2 years, she realized it would require at least $2.5 million for the first year alone to get her project off the ground. She knew this was an ambitious goal, but she felt an immediate responsibility to do it. When Kopp mentioned this figure to her thesis advisor, he exclaimed, "Do you know how hard it is to raise $2,500? Kopp actually didn't know just how hard it would be, but she was about to find out. Kopp started by building her core team for recruiting, training, and meeting her aggressive fundraising goal. She enlisted a few of the brightest people she knew, although it took a lot of convincing to get them to commit to this underfunded startup. Over the next 12 months, Kopp's leadership team went through a series of extraordinary challenges and found themselves on the brink of quitting on several occasions. But great achievers rarely give up. To make things even more difficult, while Kopp was serious about starting with 500 teachers, she was not about to accept just anyone who applied. She wanted this new program, dubbed Teach for America, to be very selective. This meant that the organization had to recruit, interview, and screen more than 2,500 applicants just to get 500 of the best and brightest graduates. Kopp felt that the organization had a responsibility to hire graduates who could have an immediate impact in the schools they joined. This series of daunting challenges was no match for Wendy Kopp's extraordinary determination and ability to execute. By April of 1990, a year after Kopp graduated from Princeton, the first 500 members of Teach for America gathered for their orientation session at the University of Southern California. Kopp had managed to raise the $2.5 million and build the organization from scratch over the span of a single year. Then, as if events simply followed the script Kopp had written in her senior thesis, the nation took notice of her bold launch. Her efforts were featured on Good Morning America and in Time magazine. A New York Times headline read, "Princeton Students Brainstorm, a Peace Corps to Train Teachers." Teach for America's first year was a remarkable success, but Kopp knew she had a responsibility to keep the organization alive and to prepare it for long-term success. In 2008, we followed up with Wendy Kopp to see how things were going at Teach for America, almost two decades after its inception. Upon entering the organization's New York headquarters, we noted that the offices still had the feel of a small startup aiming to change the world. The building was abuzz with young people rushing around close quarters filled with small cubicles and plywood desks. The water heaters in the makeshift restrooms doubled as toilet paper holders. Even in 2008, Teach for America's humble environment certainly didn't convey that of one of the most successful startups of the past century. And when we sat down with Kopp, it was clear that this superachiever remained in overdrive. Kopp was just days away from giving birth to her fourth child, yet she was in the midst of a full day at Teach for America. Although in obvious discomfort, Kopp was not about to slow down. You could tell from the look in her eyes and the passion in her voice that she is never quite content with where things are today. Kopp described how hard it had been to build an organization that now has a stable and robust flow of funding and applicants. She described her most fundamental challenge, quite succinctly, as finding talent. To keep the organization growing, Kopp had to surround herself with the best teachers, fundraisers, and leaders for the future. In her own words, talent was the key element because it, quote, solves all the other problems. It was clear from our discussion the COP had found the right people, not only to expand Teach for America, but also to make an impact on an entire nation. When we asked about the outcomes of all this hard work, COP told us that her organization's fundraising goal for the current year was a whopping $120 million. What's more, in the previous year, Teach for America had more than 25,000 applicants and is now regarded as one of the most selective and prestigious jobs in the United States, even for Ivy League graduates. In 2005, 1 in 8 Yale graduates applied for a Teach for America position. Year after year, thousands of students are now passing up six-figure salaries at high-prestige companies such as GE and Goldman Sachs to spend 2 years teaching in an inner-city school. Yet what might be an even greater legacy are the future community leaders who emerge from Teach for America's alumni. Many of today's brightest young politicians, business people, and school superintendents got their start in the organization that COP built. We interviewed a former member from Washington, D.C., who described how the head of that city's school system and half of her staff were Teach for America alumni. Nevertheless, when we asked COP about the leadership legacy she would leave, it was clear she had yet to give that question much thought. Perhaps she was too busy making things happen to wax philosophical. One of the more revealing questions we asked COP was about how she prioritizes her time. She quickly described how she starts each year with a structured list of all the things she needs to accomplish in the next 12 months. Then she breaks that list down by month and week. From the weekly list, she creates a daily to-do list that she follows rigorously. As COP talked about how she has all of this systematized, it sounded like she assumed that we all do this. For her, this level of organization is natural. COP told us, "I couldn't exist without that, or at least I couldn't be doing this job without that system." As we listened to COP, it was clear how her top five strengths played a role in the remarkable success of Teach for America. When she spoke about all the children who deserve a better education, you could hear how her responsibility theme motivates her. As one Teach for America alumnus recounted, "Wendy conveys more than her vision for educational equity, the responsibility to do something about it. To simply be the best new teacher isn't enough. Winning for the sake of students is the only option." And while COP's competition theme wasn't quite evident on the surface, it manifested in the context of winning for students in the face of the status quo. For COP, her competition was more organizational and societal than it was personal. She did everything in her power to ensure that the teachers her organization placed in schools were even better than the top teachers hired through the conventional system. Yet of all the leaders we have studied, Wendy COP may be the best example of how you can take one dominant strength, achiever in this case, and spend a lifetime applying it. From her detailed task list to building a national movement from scratch in 1 year, COP's ability to make things happen is without parallel. While her organization has already reached more than 3 million students, it is unlikely that she will rest until children all around the world have access to the education that they deserve. Influencing. The influencing themes are activator, command, communication, competition, maximizer, self-assurance, significance, woo, or winning others over. Simon Cooper is president of the Ritz-Carlton. His top five strengths are maximizer, woo, arranger, activator, and significance. When Simon Cooper assumed his role as president of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Company in 2001, he faced a unique challenge. Whereas Wendy COP essentially had to create an organization from scratch, Cooper's charge was to take one of the world's greatest brands to a new level of excellence. While it's debatable which assignment had a higher degree of difficulty, Cooper clearly had the most to lose. The Ritz-Carlton brand was already as synonymous with luxury as Kleenex is with tissue. Their employees were satisfied. Customers were engaged. Quality was ingrained in almost every aspect of the business. Expectations were sky high. And on a more personal level, Cooper was taking over for a charismatic leader, Horst Schultze, who was the brand for nearly two decades. According to Cooper, Schultze walked on water in the eyes of Ritz-Carlton's people. With this venerable brand firing on all cylinders, Cooper faced a situation in which there was almost nowhere to go but down. But nothing energizes a maximizer more than the challenge of taking a company from great to world class. When you sit in a room with Cooper, you can almost feel the power exuding from his weathered skin. Born just outside of London, Cooper once sailed charter yachts for a living and played competitive rugby until he was 45. It's still easy to see the former athlete in Cooper's stature and build. Yet his voice and accent are as sophisticated as the brand he leads. Until you get to know Simon Cooper, this refinement seems to mask his intensity and confidence. From the moment Cooper took the helm at Ritz-Carlton in 2001, he was determined to leave his mark. Like many who lead with the significance theme, the last thing he wanted to do was simply follow in the footsteps of his predecessor. As Cooper reconstructed the situation, he explained how careful he was to be clear from the outset that he was not planning to walk in someone else's shoes. In his mind, this was one sure kiss of death for anyone entering a new leadership role. Although his predecessor was widely revered, Cooper knew that the last thing people wanted was a pretender leading the organization. He also realized that the brand had to grow far beyond the personality of its leader. Instead of trying to remake a brand that was already at a pinnacle, Simon Cooper aimed to broadly expand Ritz-Carlton's global influence. He started by studying exactly what Ritz-Carlton's customers already loved, and then he sought to maximize this opportunity. For Cooper, the key was building on the strengths of the brand. He quickly realized that none of his customers truly needed to stay at a Ritz-Carlton. They could easily frequent other properties for half the price, yet they continually returned to the Ritz. So Cooper dedicated even more of his time and attention to studying the unique experience that Ritz-Carlton created for its customers. As Cooper studied his customers' attachment to the brand, he estimated that 90% of its image was emotional. It was how Ritz-Carlton's employees, quote, bring the brand to life every time they interact with a guest. Cooper described, "People create memories, not things. If we ask guests what color the carpet was in their guest room, they probably won't know. The real value comes from Ritz-Carlton's employees who bring that hotel to life. 10% is the platform, but the rest is people." Perhaps this is why Cooper finds himself in his element when spending time with Ritz-Carlton's frontline employees. During his visits, one thing Cooper loves to do is ask his associates what their guests like to buy. While he writes down their responses, which usually consists of the room, food service, or spa treatments, Cooper has another lesson in mind. His follow-up question is somewhat unorthodox. "Now tell me what they can't buy." This is what Cooper sees as his company's core value proposition, delivering the intangibles like smiles, relationships, and caring service. In a world where many guests can purchase just about anything they desire, it is the things they can't buy that create true engagement with the Ritz-Carlton brand. Cooper described how he compensates his leaders based on their ability to foster this kind of true engagement instead of basic loyalty, because they are, quote, in the business of trying to win the hearts and minds, end quote, of each guest. If they're able to do so, Simon Cooper hopes to leave behind a legacy of what he calls guests for life. Once again making the most of his top theme, Maximizer, Cooper was determined to take a legendary guest experience to an entirely different level, Gallup's initial measures of Ritz-Carlton's employee engagement levels place them in the top quartile of Gallup's worldwide database. But this was nowhere good enough for the Ritz's leadership team, who viewed this as a minimum standard. When Gallup audited Ritz-Carlton's customer engagement, they set an even higher bar. While most of their properties are above the 95th percentile in our customer engagement database, a level that most organizations consider world-class, Ritz-Carlton challenged its properties to be in the 98th to 99th percentile. If they had a property in the 94th or 95th percentile, it was considered to be in the red zone. A hotel in the 96th or 97th percentile was classified as yellow, and a property could only get to green when it reached the 98th percentile. When it comes to a guest's engagement with the brand, Cooper and team were determined to set a new gold standard. The second major initiative Simon Cooper launched was also aimed at creating lifelong guests, albeit in a more direct manner. In the face of resistance, Cooper made the case for Ritz-Carlton to move into selling private residences and fractional ownership. When Cooper introduced this concept in 2002, his judgment was called into question by the Wall Street Journal and others. They wondered if placing the iconic Ritz-Carlton logo on residences and timeshares would dilute the brand. But Cooper would hear nothing of it. Cooper had more than enough confidence to sell this concept to the world. When questioned in a 2002 interview about the 11 residences atop New York's Battery Park Hotel, Cooper quickly explained how units selling for a minimum of $25 million, which were occupied by high-profile and celebrity types, didn't exactly hurt the Ritz-Carlton image. By 2008, Ritz-Carlton's residences and fractional timeshares were the fastest-growing segment of the business, with more than 40 new locations planned around the globe. As evidenced by the financial results, this went on to become one of the best business moves in the company's storied history. A great financial success alone was probably not enough to satisfy Cooper's need to have a significant impression on the world. When we interviewed him in 2008, it was clear that he took even more pride in the global impact of his organization. Cooper casually talked about visits with kings and heads of state as if they were old friends, and he reveled in telling the story of how he asked rock star philanthropist Bono to join him in a morning meeting with the housekeeping staff during one of his recent stays. You could see how much pride Cooper took in doing little things like this to win others over. When Cooper steps back and looks at his influence leading Ritz-Carlton, he regards it in a way that may be too big for most chief executives to get their minds around. His influence is not just about maximizing one of the world's greatest brands, nor is it about doubling the total number of Ritz-Carlton properties in a mere 7 years. And it's not just about the records he set in profits, quality, or employee and customer engagement. Rather, Simon Cooper's talent for influencing serves the greater purpose of running an organization upon which the well-being of more than 40,000 families depends. As Cooper described how the paycheck of one of his frontline employees in Asia often subsidizes the food and shelter for an entire family, you could hear his significance theme resonate. Then when he talked of the night and day difference that a job at Ritz-Carlton could make for a housekeeper in the Persian Gulf, you get a sense that this is one man who realizes that he can change the world, even if that means influencing one person at a time. Relationship building. The relationship building themes are adaptability, developer, connectedness, empathy, harmony, includer, individualization, positivity, and relator. Mervyn Davies, chairman of Standard Chartered Bank, uses his top five strengths, achiever, futuristic, positivity, relator, and learner, to foster employee relationships and lead his global organization. If you try to imagine what the chairman of one of the world's largest banks might look like, Mervyn Davies would fit the bill. With his elegantly tailored suit, wire-rimmed glasses, and athletic build, Davies resembles a polished executive right out of central casting. Yet when you speak to Mervyn Davies and study his track record, it becomes clear that he's nothing like the stereotypical chief executive. From the day that Davies took over as CEO of Standard Chartered, a bank with more than 70,000 employees spread across 70 countries, he relentlessly went against the grain. Instead of thinking solely about the near term, Davies' futuristic theme kept him focused on where world markets would be several years down the road. While all of his competitors were emphasizing the then lucrative markets in Europe and North America, Davies was more interested in diversifying throughout Africa, India, and the Middle East. When other banks were investing in ways to replace people with technology, Davies wanted to invest even more time and money in developing his people. At almost every turn, Davies was leveraging his relator theme to build stronger connections throughout the organization. In an era when banking CEOs were overly cautious about what they said, Davies instead opted to over-communicate whenever possible. And while other chief executives were focused almost exclusively on their bottom lines, Davies was just as concerned with building an organization that had a heart and a soul, in his words. Before he could run Standard Chartered in such an unconventional way, Davies had to begin his tenure by building an extraordinarily diverse leadership team composed of people with vastly different backgrounds and personalities. Given that his company derived more than 90% of its revenue from emerging international markets, Davies felt that he had no choice but to ensure that the bank's leadership group was as diverse as the customers it served. Acutely aware of his own strengths and limitations, Davies set out to surround himself with people who could do specific things much better than he ever could. Throughout this process, Davies was very candid about his own personality, even placing a coffee cup with his top five themes, achiever, futuristic, positivity, relator, and learner, on his desk. He then spent an extensive amount of time analyzing the strengths and weaknesses of people around him, mapping out how they might fit on different leadership teams. This led to some unorthodox leadership choices early on. Just 1 month into the job, Davies replaced the existing CFO, who had an extensive accounting background, with a young consultant who had no formal accounting experience. What's more, this consultant was still